This is the E of Real Estate. My name is Renee Stevens. I'm your host. And today we have as guest Derek Clemens Krohm. Derek Clemens Krohm worked in the building design and contracting industry before entering university life. He has founded and directed courses including a Bachelor of Science in Building Environmental Engineering at Loughborough University, and an interdisciplinary Master of Science in Intelligent Buildings in Reading, at Reading University, covering design and management of intelligent buildings. He has also worked in architecture and building engineering at the University of Bath. He now offers strategic advice to clients, designers and facilities managers on attaining and managing healthy and sustainable environments in buildings of all types. He researches, writes, and lectures on these issues for companies and wider audiences nationally and internationally. Derek is editor and founder of Intelligent Buildings International Journal. He was involved in several international research projects and publications on intelligent buildings, sustainable design, health, and well-being. He wrote several books, of which Creating the Productive Workplace is the latest, 2018. And what I understood right now, you are working on a new book. Maybe we can cover that later on in the interview. Designing intelligent buildings and cities for people to enjoy and work in creatively and effectively is the leading theme through your career. Welcome, Derek.
Nice to be here.
In this podcast, I want to explore with you the concept of intelligent buildings and how it can be used in a learning and work environment like a university campus to boost and enhance not only the organizational goals of that organization, but also user experience. Users, not only students, but also staff. And as health and well-being, and maybe even influence the study outcome by interfering in the environment. And to me, environment consists of three parts. That is the physical part, the location, the building, the interior of the building, but also the digital environment, like the digital workplace, learning online, flipped classroom, and the social environment, not the least important. How you interact with your fellow students, with professors, and the people in general in that area. So we have intelligent, smart, and even sentient buildings. Are these words interchangeable?
Not completely, but they're interrelated. They are interrelated. Mm-hmm. I believe we use words often in a very lax way. So, for example, intelligence and smart, you can find under the same heading in the dictionary. But if you look in greater depth, you see there's many more synonyms for intelligent than there are for smart. Mm. Smart is a subset of intelligence, so it's part of it, but it's not the whole thing, because intelligence covers cognitive intelligence, emotional intelligence, practical intelligence. The smart bit usually refers in practice to more digital outputs, the smart car, the smart television, the smartphone, the smart building. And so it's a very important part of an intelligent building. But why do we have buildings in the first place? They're for people. Right. So actually the first thing is the sentient quality of the building, the meeting the needs of people, meeting the sensory needs of people. And then the third thing today, of course, is climate change and sustainability issues. And there are interrelationship between those three things, between sustainability goals, using resources in an effective, efficient way, because buildings do consume a lot of materials, a lot of water, a lot of energy, and they pollute. So we have to take care of those issues. But you're wasting your resource if you don't have a building that satisfies the needs of the occupants. And then the digital parts of the issue are the things that help some of those things to happen. So technology should be seen more as an enabler rather than a master.
Okay, you answered already my next question also a little bit. What about sustainable and green buildings? They seem to be adversely to smart buildings. But when I understand you correct, your viewpoint is more it should be holistic with the users, the people as the main core.
Yes, because in 1987, when the first United Nations statements on sustainability came out, and the key theme was improving the quality of life of people. And as many aspects of that, of course. And we're talking on a world platform here, not a specific country. And it's very complex, as we are all seeing today. But we are all involved in that issue. So the quality of life, it shouldn't mean that because you're conserving energy, saving water, and so on, that you have to have a miserable life. It means that for the world, these resources should be available for everyone and used in a sensible way. And when we all look at the feedback and we have on whether it's architecture or transport or agriculture, we are very wasteful in many ways. So there's a lot of these things, these issues that are wasted, and we can do better, much better. And we have to remember we are getting a bigger population. We're 7.5 billion now, and prediction to be over 11 billion by 2100. So we do have to give it serious attention.
So they are all complementary, in effect, all these words for building. Sometimes I think it seems to be more about smart marketing than about smart building. And other times I see people just focusing on the technical part, on the sensors and the data. And but actually it is like Vitruvius, long time back said, before Christ, Roman architect, it's about three things. Functionality, technical aspects, and aesthetics.
Aesthetics, exactly.
Yeah.
The aesthetics often, though, think it's just things you see. In my mind, aesthetics is what I call sensory aesthetics. It's our basic senses of smelling, feeling, seeing, touching, all of those. And the human being, we get bored very easily, so we actually appreciate some diversity in the environment, and that comes from the stimulation of the things about you. And so the work I'm doing at the moment on what I call a flourish model is saying you can have your basic comfort level of temperature and air, of ventilation and so on. But that in itself is only a background. On top of that, people like to have some personal control, whether you're in a home or a hospital or a university or wherever you are, some degree of self-control. It seems to be a sort of psychological requirement almost. But thirdly, there is what I call a sparkle layer. And these are the things, they may be transients. It's like getting up in the morning, opening the curtains, and you see the sunshine. Or suddenly you see the first tree blossom of spring. And those kind of surprises as you pass through the day, wherever you are really important. They can lift your spirit and help your motivation in whatever you're doing at the time. So I think that part is really most important. The technology can help you to achieve some of these things. We can talk about intelligent walls, and intelligent ways of communicating and so on. But technology on its own isn't the answer to everything. So we have to use it, I think, discreetly, because otherwise it becomes like a gimmick. The latest thing we have to use. And we're seeing a sort of reaction to this in a way that people are talking, everything's so fast. Volumes of data, more than we've ever had before. And these smart things wear out very quickly. Your phone, your television set, your computer, whatever it is. And so a lot of change very quickly. And there's a sort of unrest. It develops a restlessness in the human being, I think. And hence why things like mindfulness and meditation and yoga are very important. I work a lot with the British Council for Offices, and we do a lot of surveys on occupancy requirements. It's concentrated on offices, but some of the things they find are true of other places. And the latest one showed that 60% of that survey asked for more contemplation spaces. They were using the word contemplation in their replies. Very interesting. These are property developers and property professionals,
okay,
who could be architects, engineers, surveyors, agents, and so on. And they were saying, we need to be quiet. We do need to work together with people and in team environments, but we also need some time to think. And if we're not careful, are not giving ourselves enough time to think. Mm. And this is such an important ingredient of the workplace that we're now generating, and we're seeing emerging in offices. So, you know, this has been known throughout history, really.
Yes. But
we have to be careful we don't get swamped with the technology.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, indeed. And that's, as you said already earlier, it's all about the human beings. That's why we make those buildings in the first place.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It should be supportive to their functioning and their well-being and health.
I think supportive is a good word, yes.
It sounds so normal and down to earth, but actually many times it is forgotten.
Mm, exactly, I agree.
And how could we enhance the understanding and the awareness about this back again into to the decision maker's mind? So what I see, most often there are an organization split into silos. The professionals are split up in specialisms. Who is the conductor to bring that all together again? Or who should be the conductor?
Oh, a very good question. And I feature this in my recent book. It is not quite published yet. It's out soon, on decision making. I was very saddened by the Grenfell fire in 2017, I think it was, in London, where 72 people lost their lives. And I thought, how can this be in the 21st century that, you know, we have all fire regulations and all sorts of emergency situations, and how did this happen? And of course, there is still analysis of it taking place by various groups. So there's no output particularly yet. And then I looked back and I saw there was a fire in the Bronx in New York in 2011. Three people lost their lives, which is too many. And then, of course, we've had fires at Glasgow School of Art. Nobody lost their life, fortunately, in two times, 2014, 2018. Then we had Notre Dame, 2019. They go, oh, gosh, you know. And so this, you'd think fire is covered very well because it's life and death involvement. And what came out of the American study in 2011, after that Bronx incident, was the silo, that there was lots of information in pockets, the professionals. And I suspect for Grenfell, we will find fault lines all down the process, whether it's the local authority, the manufacturers, the consultant, the contractors. I think there's fault lines because they don't make a connection. Mm-hmm. And we've developed an education system which is emanated from the Victorian age in the UK. Now I'm talking about rather more than France and Germany, where they've perhaps done it a little better than us. We have institutions of that engineer, civil engineer, services engineer, electrical engineer. So there's all this separation. In the Victorian age, we had the Institute of Architects about 1834, we did the AA, Architecture Association about 1840, I think it was, or something like that. So there's a lot of separation, and people develop their skills in particular areas. But what's the use of being skillful in one particular area if you don't see the interconnection with the other things? Mm-hmm. And we seem to be good at analysis and poor at synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this lack of connectivity. I mean, we're now seeing much more influence from neuroscience. Mm-hmm. How the brain works. and all those neurons dashing around here, there and everywhere. But there's a fantastic interconnectivity in the brain. And I think I was at a lecture recently by the Neurodiversity Group in London, and they'd done a wonderful paper on neuroscience for cities.
Okay.
So the neurons are like the people. Mm-hmm. So all these neuron minds are dashing here and everywhere, but they, in the end, they have to come together to make decisions. So I think this is a big call now for people to come together and make sure they give the highest priority and value to how they interconnect their work. I think that's something that is a big lesson for this century.
Which function should be the most appropriate to do that? Or should it be a new function, that conductor function?
I think as regards the conductor, we often talk about who is the project manager or who should lead mm-hmm. the project. And I think it's not, I think where the fault has happened, it has to be, say, some people say it must be the architect, mm-hmm. or some people say, well, it could be the engineer or whatever. I don't think it's really discipline placed. I think it's the mind that can synthesize and bring things together. And I think if we think of the great conductors in music, the Carians, the Carl Böhm, Simon Rattles and so on, they know the detail of the instrument. They actually all played various instruments. They could play an instrument of some sort. But they had an extra thing that other people didn't have. They had the sense of being able to bring it together. Now, how they do it is a little bit of a mystery. I don't think there's a checklist of things. I think it's the ability to see the whole, to see the big picture. And I think often in projects there's not enough brainstorming. Mm-hmm. We should be actually free to realize many good ideas have come out of brainstorming sessions, and some of those ideas have seemed crazy. Mm-hmm. They've seemed mad. And I'm reminded of Abdus Salam, the Nobel laureate in physics in about the 1990s, saying that because he was getting a lot of praise for his Nobel Prize award, and he was talking a lot, and people looked up to him as an inspiring figure in physics. And he said, well, to be honest, he says, 90% of what I think about can go out of the window. The 10% is interesting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're looking for those kernels of spark, imagination, creativity that can be developed into a practical thing amongst the myriad of ideas that you have. The trouble in, I think, things like buildings is that you get somebody wanting a building, they want it on time, they've got a budget, and everything gets lost in high speed. Mm-hmm. We've got to get something out quickly. There's not enough thinking time mm-hmm. in our work. We need to think about things and let the most crazy elements be there. They will be filtered out and leave you with the residue, which will be kind of interest and make something. And the other thing in architecture, every project you do is different. Because the people who occupy the building are different. The culture of the organisation, the people they need to do the kind of work they want to do. And so that is really very important. You compare doing a law court or a hospital ward or an office or a school. All those things have got their kind of cultures within them. And you can't just do a standard type thing for a space and say, that's it. That's the blueprint. You can use that anywhere. You've got to develop your blueprint individually. And then I think you get more interesting buildings.
Yeah, actually, when I understand you correctly, you are saying there's not one conductor specific. All the specialists involved should be, in a way, leading. And see beyond the horizon of their silo border and see to the other professions involved. But you can also argue that the principal, he or she should be more involved and not give it just to an architect or a project manager or a project developer or a real estate agent. because it's their office or their building or their university campus. Because when the specialists have left the architect and the constructing building, they have to use it for several years. And who is then looking after it that is matching? Mm-hmm. Because you have your schedule of requirements. Mm-hmm. Then you get your building after 2-3 years. Mm. There's a check. Do I get what I ordered? Mm. But then, who is watching that there is a match between the building and the occupants after that?
I think we've got to go back to the germination of the idea for the building you're talking about on the project and look at where that comes from, the big picture. And I think it's people... who the leader are the ones that can work between the disciplines rather than within a discipline. Mm-hmm. And there's another aspect I would like to suggest. And I did this recently working with the British Council of Offices on a particular project. We've got used to the architect, the planner, the engineer, the facilities manager, all of these people, very important, of course. But the rate of knowledge, if you take my area of health and well-being, is changing so rapidly. You can't expect an architect engineer to have all up to date all the time because they've got to occupy themselves with other things. So I believe we need to be much more open to interventions by disciplines outside. Mm-hmm. So occupational psychology, ergonomics. Let's take one example to illustrate what I mean. If we look at the absenteeism and presenteeism figures in the United Kingdom, the highest level of absenteeism, medical absence, is musculoskeletal, then mental stress, then things like building sickness syndrome. Musculoskeletal. Why is that happening? Arms, backs, eyes up to a point. Well, it's a number of things, but a lot of it's to do with office furniture. Mm-hmm. And if you look at many briefs of buildings, you rarely find the word ergonomics there. And yet, we've got a lot of information about the best way of accommodating people of all different sizes into desks or tables or whatever it is in the space. And the same with relationship to the machine like the computer. You know, how you sit and face with the computer or the computer design itself, which in some ways is wonderful, but in other ways it's very wearing on the body, on arms and fingers, eyes and so on. And often we develop things and don't think about the health things at all. And so ergonomics is a very neglected area. Now, if we extend that into other things like psychology and occupational psychology in particular and so on, it would be very useful, I think, to have interventions by people in those fields that could come in at the beginning of the job to update people with the most reliable information available to make sure that's built into the project. Mm-hmm. And also when you're doing your post-occupancy evaluation, when the building is occupied, they could also be involved.
That should be.
Yes.
Because the organisation is not static.
And there's an extra point that those people have no vested interest in the building itself.
Yeah.
They're giving you a completely objective information. And sometimes there are complications with vested interests and so on. Mm-hmm. And then I think the leader, you see, let's think about now. My favourite orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And what happens when they want to elect another conductor? And they go through quite a process of deciding this. And I think there should be a really concerted effort to employ a building integrator. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's perhaps not the best word, but you've got the idea.
Yes.
And that building integrator may come from all sorts of places, maybe an international person even. Mm-hmm. They should come in because it's like bringing in an outsider in, but they're coming in because they've established their reputation of being able to understand, communicate, vital, communication between disciplines. Mm-hmm. They're not an expert in architecture or engineering, but they can see the connections, points, and the leader must be able to do that. If they can't, it's very difficult. I think we ought to go learn from other leadership models. And we've never done that in architecture. I think we've still been arguing about the architect and the engineer and something. And look at Arup. I mean, what was his big thing? I showed this to students. I mean, when you see what he put, he just simply said, we must all work together. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, yes, it's obvious. Yeah. Then you think, oh, well, why doesn't it happen all the time? And you know, then you go into all sorts of reasons why that hasn't happened. And then Arup, I've got a copy of a letter that Walter Gropius wrote to Arup in about 1965 or something like that. And Arup had obviously had discussions with him about the architect is part engineer, the engineer is part architect.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And then, but you've got this architect, very world-renowned architect, Gropius, saying to Arup, engineer, I think you're right. Agreed. This letter, write it out, letter. Wonderful, wonderful letter. And I show this to my students because I believe very much that architecture has become a little bit stultified in its thing. But so is engineering.
Yeah,
so it's not just architects. Yeah. But when you start working together like in the Arup way, I think you can get a wonderful combination of effort.
Indeed. So you sometimes hear sentences or read sentences like an intelligent building or a smart building can become an energy generator. And then in a literary sense that it produces energy instead of consumes energy. But you can also see it in a more broader perspective that it is an energy generator for the people occupying the building.
Mm.
So they become more charged, and instead of depleting their life, vital life force energy, and for that you need integration, as you said.
Yes. I mean, that's an interesting point you've made there. I mean, we use the word energy, and in architecture, it's often to do with the carbon energy and heat losses and gains and so on. And but coming inside the building, we rarely talk about human energy.
Yes.
And we start talking about productivity and how to measure it and that. And I think like that's an end point. Underlying productivity in how a person works is their health and well-being.
Exactly.
Because that's key to their motivation. And underlying their health and well-being is their human energy.
Indeed.
If you're low in energy, you don't work as well.
Yeah.
If you're good in energy, you're a good, happy energy level, then it works fine usually. So we ought to remember that. There's also an interesting about behaviour. Behaviour depends on three main things. One is motivation, one is ability, and one is the challenges, the triggers to your motivation. And it's like the support systems in the building you were talking about earlier. That's the we can give support in various ways, might be the IT systems or whatever it is, or the food and the gym or whatever that is. The ability we can't do much about, but it's a natural thing of the person. But the motivation we can affect. Now, obviously, people have aspirations and they set about their careers and their work interest is obviously primary.
Mm-hmm.
But we can help that position of health and well-being to help the motivation process in the work by, you know, natural light, lovely fresh air conditions, colour, various diversity of interest in the environment, you know, variations of space and giving place to think and contemplate as well as work in teams, all of those things. Can be part of the process, the look and feel of a place.
Mm-hmm.
You came into this room and said, oh, this is a nice place. You first time, you've never been before.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you say that? well, of the light, then look around. And, you know, you just think of your own experiences of when you go into buildings. And often your first impression is usually correct.
Exactly.
And you work better in places you like.
Indeed. That brings me to the point that when you make the comparison with computers, I think almost everybody understands when you get a computer, it is handy when you read the manual or you get an instruction or you get the training to how to use that device. But when we make buildings, there is no manual. How to clean the windows and do the maintenance, but not actually how to use it as a management tool or as a tool to provide a working environment or a learning environment or whatever environment for the people and the processes in that thing. So in the beginning I said environment is three main parts: physical part, digital part, but also the social part. So when the management levels in a organization are not aware how to use that device we call building, then we can have the most perfect building, the most perfect computer, but
I think what's often forgotten is that all the effort goes into designing this fantastic building and all the hopes are there, and the problems in construction are often then the contracting stage. But even if then all that's worked extremely well and you've got a really good building, it's forgotten that you have to care for things. If you don't care, they deteriorate. So the facilities manager has got a vital role in this process, and I think they should be involved at the start of the project, in fact.
Exactly.
They have I think the facilities manager in UK is often associated largely with maintenance, and they used to have maintenance and terror technology and so on, and that was not very popular because it was like fixing the boiler or something very mundane, shall we say, important, but kind of mundane routine, and people lost interest in it. But it's much bigger than that now. It's dealing not only with your physical systems, it's dealing with how they affect people in the workplace. So facilities managers, there are one or two courses around, not enough, unfortunately, are ones that show how they work with the occupants of the building as well as the actual hardware systems to work together. And the other aspect I'm thinking is that we tend to think of buildings as static objects. And I prefer, in fact, I'm now teaching with my students that don't think of buildings like that, think of them as organisms. And this is becoming clear as we see we can have materials that have, for example, bacteria which activate microcells and so on in bricks and various other materials. We're introduced more greenery, more living. So living things, we know, are becoming more embedded into solid materials. And so really, it is literally true that the buildings are more like organisms, mushroom towers and various things. If you think of it that, then just like we have to go to the doctors or try to keep our health well by having healthy eating, the healthy eating part is the facilities managers in buildings. We have to nourish the building and the systems to keep it all working at the highest, most effective level we can.
So you are putting the emphasis on that we are not really in need of an even smarter building, but smarter use of that smart building.
Smarter use of the building. I'm not saying we don't use any technology, because they can be very helpful. For example, robotic maintenance is a good example of which is very effective and can help in many ways. I think it's the relationship between things, again, that comes into it. We forget that our environment affects our minds, not just the physical body bit. I did some research in schools. We had a number of primary schools around the Reading area, and I managed to get a government contract to look at the effect of CO2 on pupils' performance. And this was published about 2012. And the team I got together was at Reading University with the Departments of Psychology and the Built Environment Construction Part Management and Engineering. And we worked together on this project. And the outcome of 3 years of doing all of this tests, blind, double-blind experiments, was that, in fact, you know, the air quality does affect the student performance. We gave them, you know, colour recognition tests, reaction time tests, some maths tests and so on. So the relationship between the environment is also important in cognitive function. Of how we then that leads to concentration. And there's a lot of other people done this work in America and in Netherlands and Denmark, finding similar things. We've tended to think it's all about the respiratory system and the health. And that's important as well, of course, mm-hmm. Very important. But it's the mind and the physical body that we're talking about.
Indeed.
So then we see about these figures on productivity, that only something like 15 to 30% of people are really focusing in the workplace. Because you come back to the brain. If, for example, you've got unhealthy air in the building, this affects the oxygenation in the blood, and this immediately shows up in the brain, whether it's tired and sluggish, as opposed to being alert and has vitality.
Mm-hmm.
So... I think that's something else that we ought to recognise, and often this is a bit of a mystery to people. How does, you know, the environment affect the brain, sort of thing, or the mind, I should say? Then it in fact it does. And if you put all this together with the facts that we're getting increased asthma in buildings and so on, with the physical effects, gosh, we've got a long way to go to get healthy, well-being buildings properly. And if you haven't got those, it's not surprising productivity in the country is perhaps not what it should be in the case of the UK. So, you know, there's a number of interconnected things, and we've been all in our separate little parts.
Exactly. We were discussing already the silos in organisations and the specialisms in our field of architecture and buildings. But even the whole industry of buildings, you should look broader than that, like neuroscience, you mentioned already, and make that combination.
Yes.
Because when we try to optimize the body, but does not stop at this borders of this body, it's also this room is not part of it, and also the air outside, and the climate and the nature. So I think when we would more cross-pollinate between disciplines, I think we could make a really, really big innovation leap.
Mm.
What's your opinion about that?
Well, yes. I mean, all these interconnections. I was just thinking again about, you know, pollution and carbon and so on. And, of course, we know that we've got figures on mortality, on various respiratory illnesses and so on. And of course we are generating, I mean, we talk now in the UK, we've just talked to him about wood fires and coal burning and has to be out by 2024, I think, or something. And it's true. But of course, you know, the thought of wood fires is quite a pleasant thought and attractive in some ways. But, oh, well, there's a downside which we now realised, you know, that the carbon. And I think we're concentrating at the moment on certain size particles, and we've stopped at 2.5 micron. But actually, from the point of view of the lung system, ultrafine particles are also important, but we haven't usually measured those. So, and often, if you look at the monitoring, I have been a commissioner in Hammersmith on air quality. The monitoring's terrible, but that's not just Hammersmith. It's many places. It's very, very, very crude monitoring systems, and which leads to the general thing. We do have to measure more. We have to monitor rather than just talking about Indeed. Things loosely, we do have to monitor. And I think we are beginning to monitor more. So that's good. We have to monitor. And now we've got systems which we can monitor. The prices of those systems are usually reducing, and they're easy to use, and they're smaller, and everything's more portable and accessible. So we've got no excuse now to make sure that when we're designing a building, planning a building, we help the facilities manager with good monitoring. And that isn't just measuring the temperature and the fluid flow. It's much more involving the people as well as the systems.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. So that was already quite something we addressed. So you take all these in consideration, and you think yourself back 20, 30 years. Is there something that you would say, no, I would, that I had the knowledge 30 years back already? That would really make a big difference.
Well, for me, I started at the age of 16. I was in an apprenticeship with a heating and ventilating firm in Birmingham. I did go to university till later. I was thrown into contracting offices, and I was thrown into design offices, which, and I could see the difference of culture just in the same building between these two departments. And then I did spell in research with this company, the same company. I was with the company 11 years. One day, so here's a 16-year-old who knows nothing very much, very diligently getting on and trying to learn quickly and do my courses and all the rest of it. But after 2 or 3 years, I always remember one day, for just out of the blue, I looked down the office and I thought, gosh, I'm designing these radiator systems for buildings. And I also did radiant warm air systems for factories in the West Midlands. I was working in Birmingham at the time. I thought, am I going to be doing this when I'm 50? Mm. And I remember thinking, oh. And then the thought went away. I thought, got on with my work. And that. So as I was going along, somehow I was realizing there's limitations in what I was doing. But not really, as I was trying to understand what I was doing, I realized this didn't seem kind of right. And a lot of talk was about comfort. And it seemed to me comfort could be quite debilitating because it's very static and neutral. And of course, we still talk a lot about comfort. I'm trying to persuade people to think about flourish, the one I mentioned earlier. And I was then given a spell in research, I worked on the site for 6 months, I worked in contracting for 18 months, I worked in design, so I had all the hurly-burly of practice. And I thought, there must be a better way, because everything seemed to be in a dash. It was often to do with money, it was often to do with high speed. In the contractor's office, it was crazy, getting the job out here and that, and a lot of shortcuts taken. And I thought, we are designing buildings for people. So this designing for people bit happened quite early on. In 1975, I was asked by the director for the Building Services Information Research Association to consider writing a book. Well, I was very young. I'd never done anything like that before. I'd written little papers and so on, but I hadn't really done that. By which time I had moved into university life at Loughborough. And I thought, oh, God, I've sort of said yes. And then I said, oh, well, can I bring somebody in to write on equipment and practical hardware stuff? And this was the first book, 11 chapters. And he did, Brian, my colleague, did three on equipment stuff, which he dealt with all the time he was in practice. And I wrote the other stuff. And I did do it. It was published by Bergerman. And then, to my surprise, I then found it was translated into Chinese and Russian. Mm. It had taken off. Now, within that book, to come back to your question, if you look at the stuff I wrote in that book, it was talking about having a new building council, bringing the disciplines together, a little bit of what we spoke about earlier. There was a lot about
trying to understand how the mechanism in the brain worked without going into neuroscience. Mm-hmm. It was just how, when you go into a place, how do your senses kind of work? Mm-hmm. And it was an elementary start of me trying to work out, because I'd been working in the Department of Human Sciences at Loughborough University. I'd been working amongst biologists and psychologists, so I learnt a lot. I then really worked on that for many years, and it sort of emerged as it is today, I suppose. So the roots of it started in practice, realizing there seemed to be limitations to what I was doing, but exactly what it was, mm-hmm. I had to kind of discover and find my way. But what came out, I've moved from hardware stuff, because I used to do hardware systems myself, mm-hmm. and I moved more into the soft end of that, the results, the output, how those heart systems mm-hmm. affect us in the workplace.
Exactly.
And that's how it happened. And in 1980, the Building Services Research and Technology Journal asked me to do a paper on post-occupancy evaluation. And their 40th anniversary, they happened to ask me again, would I like to update that paper? And now I'm saying the sort of things we're talking about this morning, flourish, model, but a more dynamic way of looking at the environment, doing measurement with wearables, for example. We can measure ourselves mm-hmm. much more. We are good human. Human beings are good instruments. Mm-hmm. We can do a lot ourselves, mm-hmm. much more measurement. And so an update. And now we're developing metrics. We have the ways of rating buildings using BREEAM and LEED, but we now have a well from America as well. We're actually looking at rating how well your building will do on a health and well-being scale. So we are getting quite practical about these matters. So it's been a very slow, gradual progression, which started by me having to do hardware systems and buildings.
So it would be an advantage when we can bring more awareness about this, that although you are in hardware, take in mind for whom are you designing this constructing this, and who is it going to be used. And think when you would be the user, what would you like? Many times there's too much focus on money. Money is important, time is important, also too much focus on that. We're squeezing out office space because there's vacancy. But we learned already in chicken farming or pig farming that when you make the space too tight, put them all in a cage,
it is not very well stressed.
And now we are doing similar thing with people.
Human beings.
Just to save a few bucks, but not realizing how much money is lost.
I mean, hotel desking, for example, pushing people together, like as close as we are here, onto that. Now, if you do that for an odd hour or two, no problem. Mm-hmm. But to do it for 7 or 8 hours a day for 5 days a week, very unhealthy. And now we see the Edge buildings in Amsterdam, for example, mm-hmm. the Edge Deloitte and the Edge Olympic, which feature in my book. And they have no assigned desk places, and it's open. And you could choose using your app, because people aren't in every day of the week for a start. But also, it develops this lovely, open, free communication atmosphere. There are places where you can go and think quietly somewhere, or you can be in the communal space and share that. And I think it's wonderful. And there are lots of light and those basic things. I was fortunate after my initial industrial position, when I went to Bath University, I was invited by Ted Happold, who had moved to be professor there from Arup. So he had an Arup-type thinking mind in a way. And he started his own practice, Bureau Happold, which is now kind of very distinguished in its own right. Sadly, he passed away in 1996. But I had the fortune of working with him for a few years at Bath University. And that was a chance to see another type of firm, and a firm that I could identify with myself. I thought they are thinking about the human beings, they're thinking about communities. And this is why Bureau Happold and Arup and other such like companies are successful, I think, because you know, it's about people at the end of the day.
Looking into the future, what are your aspirations and goals for the coming 5 years?
Well, that's a big question. Well, I want to, I suppose, if we come down to briefly expressing something, I am concerned about climate change, but I'm an optimist. I think we use imagination and really think a little bit more about how we do things. We can do things better, so I'm an optimist. At the same time, that doesn't compromise health and well-being in buildings. So I would like to see a better world, and because we spend 90% of our time in buildings, most of us, then architecture is very important in all of this discussion. So I would like to, you know, make contribute. I think everybody needs to contribute, however small it is, towards getting a better world. And my area happens to be in buildings, but other people in transport and various things. And looking with my students, opening up the mindset, I'd like to feel we could move a little bit more flexibly, adaptable, and change our mindsets and cross sectors. I think it's really important to cross sectors. I'm a fan of E.O. Wilson, who wrote the Biophilia book 1984, but he wrote The Origins of Creativity in 2017, and in that he's saying, you know, whether you're in natural sciences or social sciences or the arts, we should work more together. And I think that's something I really profoundly believe in.
Is that also the theme of your latest book that is coming out soon?
Well, yes, I've got 8 chapters. It's Designing Buildings for People, and its subtitle is Sustainable Livable Architecture. So it sounds quite ordinary, I suppose. But the 8 chapters, well, the 8th chapter is a gallery of pictures from various practices that have been kind enough to cooperate with me on showing their best work. And it's a wide range. But the other chapters are emphasising that history is important. The passive design, vernacular architecture. Absolutely important. Sounds is very simple, but it is absolutely very important. You can save a lot of energy using the lessons from history. The third chapter is about lessons from biology, the biological world, biomimetics and biophilia. And I've, again, very lucky, I've written something about that, but I've introduced a great scientist who's working at Catalunya University in Spain, who's doing some really mind-boggling work on how we can improve, for example, street lighting without electricity. Wow, gosh. Yeah. I've got a little picture showing his demonstration. Using chemical luminescence of lemon trees and so on. That's just one little example. I've got another architect I invited to come in who's done a biophilic classroom in Putney down the road here. So a nice practical example. Now, fourth chapter's about health and well-being. So, fifth chapter is about technology. It's all the upsides and the downsides. Sixth chapter is about sustainability. Seventh one is about decision making.
Okay.
And hits on some of the points we've had in this discussion, because I think we really need to look into a more transdisciplinary way of doing things. And the eighth one is the gallery of examples. So it's practical, but trying to inject a few different ideas in the process. And because I believe that in the end, the best buildings, best architecture, best cities are ones that naturally are natural in their response to things. So simple and simplicity, nothing wrong with simplicity. I think sometimes perhaps we get too complex. A little bit more simple.
when a person from a management board of a university campus is listening to this interview, say, well, there's something to it. What would you advise that person to start with in his university campus to apply some of these things to enhance student experience, staff experience, and maybe even study outcome?
Well, I think first of all, Ted Apple was very good at doing this. You need to get a good team of people together at the start who are committed. You've got to set up a value, a mission, and people got to feel involved. So that group needs to involve students, staff, and not just the heads of people, just range of staff and students, also the management people and the estate people, of course. The driver, if you think of cathedrals, why are they great? And try and put your mind back. I've got to spend a book on cathedrals as they were envisaged at that. And, I mean, the uplift there was in religion and God and so on. Okay, that's how I think of it. But, you know, a university has a very high aim, really.
Indeed.
You know, education, really high aim.
And a big responsibility also.
And a big responsibility. So let's be passionate. I think you need to have some passion in things.
Yes.
And a common belief. And also, if people feel occupants of whether it's universities or wherever, are happier if they are engaged in the process. Engage the people in the process as well, make part of it. And I think you, rather than just do cold spaces on a functional accommodation basis, actually make these what I call a living laboratory, and have vision, so you can see that you go into your room and you can see the energy going down the wall. You know, make it alive, make it a live thing. Okay. I don't think this will go down very well, but not with the accountants and so on, but I would suggest more interdisciplinary spaces in the university, because I'm sure that's where we have to be. You can still go back to your particular laboratory on doing a very particular thing. Nobody's going to take any of that away, but on top of that, we want so. If we now look at some of the latest, not the Wolfson, there are some recent laboratories that have been done in London. We should be looking at those examples of how they're trying to encourage cross-flow communication. Because the best ideas come from when people mix together from all sorts of angles. And I would say that in a university setting should be vital. And that affects it affects students as well. It's not just for the teachers, because if they're inspired and teachers are finding good things in new things, that feeds onto the students, onto the learning process. And it may be that we can have more computer learning, say, you know, do you really need to have lots and lots of lectures on thermodynamic principles, or could you do that a little bit more by some computer learning system? Maybe enhanced by some tutorials, maybe, and then perhaps spend more of your contact time into interdisciplinary groups.
Yes.
And you know, I think that might be an interesting thing to consider.
Yes, I agree. Well, Derek, it was fantastic sharing ideas and hearing your thoughts about actually coming back to the basics. We build for people.
Exactly.
And we can make it very complicated and subdivided and go on and on until it's such a small atom piece and that you don't see the whole thing anymore.
That's right. And then it goes wrong. Absolutely.
So thank you for your inspiration and your sharing that hopefully it will add on to building on awareness about people in the field, that they have to approach it again from a holistic point of view.
It's been a great pleasure. Lovely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.